Tom, earlier on, you were telling me about a kind of project that the New York intellectuals were engaged in, which was the attempt, an attempt to build bridges between modernism and radical political thought and theory. Can you tell us more about what kind of synthesis the New York intellectuals were attempting and to what degree you thought they were successful?
Well, I think that the synthesis was an attempt to explore the realm of consciousness, which was increasingly becoming a main focal point of interest for Western Marxists in Europe, but I think also a lot of these anti-Stalinist Marxists in New York. The expectations regarding the working class and what was taking place with the working class, it was starting to become clear that those expectations didn't appear to be accurate. And so an aesthetic sensibility that had the potential, or a philosophical sensibility or a sociological sensibility that had the ability to explore that realm of consciousness and to really... This is part of the reason why Freud becomes so popular for so many of these people during this period of time. Freud becomes another theoretical tool for trying to explain the kinds of non-rational drives that exist at the core of people personally. So I think that that's one of the things that attracted the New York intellectuals to modernism as well. They become interested in Freud quite a bit later than the Frankfurt School does. And I think that the Frankfurt School is actually one of the reasons that they become as interested in Freud as they do. But it's this realization, I think, on the part of lots of leftists all over the world that the kind of highly rationalistic explanation of human drives and nature that lay at the work of Marx and Engels and the Second International, that those assumptions had to be seriously interrogated and reinvestigated. And so modernism seemed to be a fruitful place to conduct those types of investigations. Now, what's awkward, I mean, there also were many of the New York intellectuals who just, it was their preference. They liked modernism. And one of the things that was very awkward for them is how do you reconcile a love of a reactionary writer like Ezra Pound or T.S. Eliot with these political sensibilities that you have? Nevertheless, they tried. And despite the fact that the political intentions and aims of the author might be totally distasteful to you, the nature of the work itself may help to uncover useful realizations about contemporary social reality that might be of use in a political context. And so I think that a lot of the work that the New York intellectuals were engaged in was attempting to do that. What they also wanted to do was to try and theorize about how aesthetic modernism fit together with aesthetic radicalism, and they really had a lot of problems with that. I mean, the closest that they came to a really highly developed theory of that was this essay that Clement Greenberg published called Avant-Garde and Kitsch. But, you know, I mean, really, it wasn't until the Frankfurt School came along and made the proposition that it's not just art's ability to expose these deeper psychological levels of consciousness that makes modernism interesting and significant on a social theoretical level. I mean, the other thing that they claimed, I mean, you had two schools of thought within the Frankfurt School. I mean, on the one hand, you had someone like Marcuse, who really believed that art was a way of seeking utopia. And so it is within art that one imagines the beautiful and the good, and that therefore it serves this really vital purpose. In the case of Adorno, I think, you know, a lot of his aesthetic theory tended to be much more critical and negative because his assessment of the world in many respects was a lot bleaker than Marcuse's. And that was in this world of total administration, complete conformity, and total domination, not only do you have a regression, an artistic regression in the imagination of the audience, you also have a regression in the minds of critics as well as in the minds of artistic producers, so that you actually see autonomous art very rapidly vanishing. Not only the market space for it vanishing, but literally it vanishing. And so the art that Adorno came to appreciate is the art that was defiant in its relationship to the status quo. So it was art that refused to be appropriated. And, you know, I mean, think of the music of Schoenberg. I mean, the Boston Symphony Orchestra was doing these Beethoven programs a couple of years ago. But the reason that they were doing Beethoven so much, they did all of Beethoven's symphonies, but they would always pair it with something by Schoenberg or one of Schoenberg's students. And James Levine said in the press, the reason that we're doing this is because people hate Schoenberg, but they should hear him and they should know him. So.
Well, I want to move on to Marcuse in the 1960s and 70s, but certainly people can pick up Thomas Wheatland's book, The Frankfurt School in Exile, and read the rest of this chapter, which basically concludes with, Tom, your assertion that the two groups, the New York intellectuals and the Frankfurt School, were largely held apart, and they did not intervene in their respective histories until it was largely too late. But time is fleeting. I want to move on to Marcuse, known for his books like One Dimensional Man and Eros and Civilization. He came up with a systematic critique of capitalism, and the mainstream press back then, and perhaps even some observers of left movements, of the new left in the 60s, represented that Marcuse had become a kind of guru of the new left, of the student radicals, of people in movements like Students for a Democratic Society. What did you learn about the extent to which student radicals, young radicals, read Marcuse and were influenced by him?
Well, I want to preface this response by saying I did not expect to uncover the results that I did. I expected, based on everything that I'd ever read, that there would be this robust Marcuse reception that I could study and could perhaps use to make better sense of the different constituencies that made up the new left. And I thought that there would be that Marcuse reception because there were so many press sources that suggested that it existed, but also because so many historians, I think largely reacting to those press responses, insisted that it existed. And so I thought, you know, Marcuse, being as rich and complex a thinker as he was, he would be a topic of much writing and discussion in various underground newspapers, the counterculture, as well as in more official new left outlets. So I went through all the papers of Students for a Democratic Society and their various publications. And much to my surprise, there's almost no mention of him in any of these written sources prior to 1968. He almost never comes up. The thinkers that do come up are C. Wright Mills, Gandhi, Thoreau, Che Guevara, Fanon, Castro, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. But Marcuse hardly does. After 1968, a little bit more, but not enough to comment a whole lot about, and not enough to really constitute or to bear out this kind of guru reputation that he got saddled with by the press in the wake of 1968.
And in searching for reasons for what you found, you alert the reader to the difference, which we pretty much all know, about theory and practice. Which of these two did Students for a Democratic Society and other New Left organizations, which of these two did they emphasize, and how did Marcuse feel about that emphasis?
Well, their emphasis was clearly on practice and on action. The SDS was really built out of the freedom rides. They referred to themselves as the beloved community. They referred to themselves as a movement. It was through action that they developed an identity of themselves and also started recognizing their own agency to make change. Marcuse, I think, looked at a lot of these efforts as noble but misguided. I think that he had a lot of admiration for SDS and thought that they were motivated by all the right humanitarian impulses. But what drove him crazy was their anti-intellectualism and their discomfort with theory. He, like all of the other members of the Frankfurt School, really believed that theory was a necessary precursor to practice. And I think as SDS and the New Left in general continued on their path, you know, Marcuse sort of walked a fine line between being a critic and being a cheerleader. But I think that it, I mean, in some ways, much of its implosion bears out the Frankfurt School's concerns with privileging practice over theory, that theory was lacking, and theory is ultimately part of what caused the movement to implode in the dramatic way that it did.
Thomas Wheatland joins us from Boston, from MIT. He is an assistant professor of German history at Assumption College, and he is author of The Frankfurt School in Exile. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. One provocative claim you make in this book goes to the influence that the student radicals had on Marcuse, as opposed to the traditional storyline of about Marcuse influencing so many of these members of the New Left. In what ways did you find the student movements of the 60s and 70s influencing Herbert Marcuse?
I think what they did for him is they helped reconcile a tension that had existed within his social theory that he'd been writing since he had settled in the United States. So if you think about Marcuse's work, one of his famous books from the 1950s is Eros and Civilization. It's a fairly utopian, optimistic book that revises Freud in some significant ways to make a very compelling argument that a less repressive, more joyous existence is possible with certain necessary social changes. On the other hand, Marcuse also produced books like One Dimensional Man, his other sort of classic piece of social theory. This one was written in 1964. And that book, by contrast, contains none of that utopianism or optimism. I mean, he really seems to be suggesting that those avenues for hope and for change are very rapidly starting to vanish, and that there's no hope in the West, that there's a kind of pernicious, soft totalitarianism that's prevalent. And by the same token, there's no hope in the Soviet world either, where there's this hard mode of totalitarianism. And I think when the student movement came along, they seem to be symptomatic of the more hopeful social theory that is contained in Eros and Civilization. So you have these students reacting with such anger and frustration and alienation at a time of relative prosperity. I think one of the things that rattled people so much about the meteoric rise of the New Left is how there didn't seem to be a whole lot of troubles on the horizon, and it arose so rapidly. And so Marcuse, his diagnosis was, well, the New Left, they're not necessarily the new revolutionary agent of change that's going to replace, you know, the working class and his vision of Marxian social change, but they do represent this new progressive emerging sensibility where these students are recognizing the emptiness of affluence, the wastefulness that seems to go hand in hand with the kind of affluence that exists in the United States. And then by the same token, the kind of insane destructive capabilities that have been mounted to defend the United States and its way of life during the Cold War. So you think, you know, back on the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of these very close calls and the insane rise of the arms race during that period. So the students recognized this, they felt this, the hypocrisies within American society that they witnessed and reacted to in connection with the civil rights movement. I mean, all of this was a form of, you know, very rudimentary, imminent critique of existing social conditions. I think what Marcuse was excited about is that these students on an instinctual level understand that there's something profoundly wrong, and they may not know what to do with this realization, but trying to make progressive change is what they are committed to attempting. And so in that sense, they came to represent something very powerful and very useful to him. I mean, I think ultimately what it all started to remind him of in some ways, although probably not as dramatically, is what he'd witnessed when he was relatively the same age, a college student living in Berlin, watching the Spartacist winter in 1919 and wondering whether or not these young people in the streets in the wake of the First World War were really going to fundamentally change the world for the better.
So we've talked about Marcuse and the New Left. There's much more in this book about that, of course, and also the Frankfurt School's relationship to the New York intellectuals. What are some of the other things you address in this book?
Well, so I address the sort of more formal institutional relationships that the Frankfurt School has to this country. So I look at why they wound up in this country, especially at Columbia University, and how their relationships with Columbia University affect the subsequent history of the institution. I also, and this is probably one of the more significant pieces of the book that really represents a pretty big chunk of it, I do spend some time also looking at the Frankfurt School in relation to the history of U.S. sociology. And in that sense, I look at them as an example, if you will, of one force that is helping to build a bridge between European social theorizing and American imperial sociological research. And, you know, I mean, there are numerous other examples. But then lastly, I would say the other big nugget in here, this is talked about in connection with the New York intellectuals, but it's really a separate topic in and of itself. And that has to do with the Frankfurt School's relationship to American pragmatism. To a lot of philosophers, this is it's maybe a strange thing to think about, because when one thinks of Jürgen Habermas, who is a second-generation Frankfurt School, Jürgen Habermas has a completely peaceful relationship with pragmatism, but that was not the case with the first generation that was in exile in this country. And so that part of the book looks at the relationship between critical theory and specifically the pragmatist variety that comes from John Dewey.
The book is The Frankfurt School in Exile. Very interesting, very well written. The author is Thomas Wheatland, assistant professor of German history at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts. We have a link to his faculty page at Assumption. Thanks so much, Thomas, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Theis.
And that link is on againstthegrain.org. Tom joined us from the studios of Academic Media Production Services at MIT. I want to thank Rene Buisson at Assumption College for arranging that venue. This is Against the Grain on KPFA. Sally Phillips is at the controls. I'm C.S. Song. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org. And thanks to Sally Phillips, who was at the controls today.